Welcome to the Friday edition of the Stanza Festival Poetry Podcast. On today's edition, we feature the cream of the International Younger Poets event. You get to hear an excerpt from Greville Lindop's Stanza lecture from yesterday, which was part of one of Stanza's two themes this year, that of poetry and myth and legend. But we also had the opportunity to hear from Greville under the other theme of this year's festival, Brian Johnson's Director's Cut, where he joined poet Jean Spracklund. Fellow Stanza podcaster Al Innes catches up with Stanza's artist in residence this year, Jay Bernard. And we also hear from Jamaican poet Kai Miller reading some excellent new work. But first, it's over to Stanza's lecturer this year, Greville Lindop, with an excerpt from his lecture, Myth, Magic, and the Future of Poetry. And in this excerpt, Greville discusses the origins of poetry from the Celtic tradition.
We find a Celtic myth of the origin of poetry in the Mabinogion, in the story of Taliesin. Here, poetry originates with the enchantress Ceridwen, who boils up a cauldron of inspiration and wisdom. Notice again the pairing of poetry with the idea of wisdom or knowledge. Ceridwen's cauldron was full of special herbs, and it had to boil continuously for a year and a day. Every day, Ceridwen went out to gather fresh herbs, and so she would leave a boy, little Gwion Bach, to stir the cauldron while she was out. But one day, as the cauldron bubbled, 3 drops of the brew flew out and landed on little Gwion's finger. Instantly, he put his finger in his mouth, and at once he became able to see into the future because of those drops from the cauldron. And what did he see? He saw that when the year and the day had gone by, Ceridwen was going to kill him. So he ran away, wouldn't you? And once he'd stopped stirring the pot, it broke in two from the heat and the magical liquid was spilled and lost. Ceridwen, the sorceress, went after Gwion Bach, and they go through one of these mythical chase and pursuit stories. Gwion turns himself into a hare, and she turns herself into a greyhound and goes after him. They go through a whole series of changes. Eventually, Gwion Bach turns himself into a grain of corn on a threshing floor in the barn. But she turns herself into a hen and swallows him. Ceridwen thought she was rid of him, but she found that she was pregnant. And after 9 months, she gave birth to him as a beautiful boy. She couldn't bear to kill him. He was so beautiful. She sent him off down the river like Moses, and eventually he came to land and became known as Taliesin, or Shining Brow. And even as a child, his poems were so fine that he became the greatest bard of his time. He was also an enchanter, because the intoxicating drink in Ceridwen's cauldron brought magical knowledge as well as poetic inspiration. So again, you have those two sides to the story. The connection between poetry and magical powers was equally emphasised in medieval Ireland. Here the poet was known as a fili, a word which meant originally seer. Poets in early medieval Ireland were expected to have powers of clairvoyance. I quote from Celtic scholar John Carey, "Various early legal sources make it clear that anyone aspiring to be recognised as a master poet or orator must not only be fully trained and artistically gifted, but must also possess the clairvoyant faculty known as imbas phorosnai, the great knowledge which illuminates. This imbas could reveal the secrets of the past, present and future." And Carey tells us that a master poet's job normally included warding off enchantments from the king at Halloween. So the poet was expected to be clairvoyant and a magician, as well as to make poetry. We have confirmation of this in the early Irish epic, The Toine, or Cattle Driving of Cooley, which dates from before the 6th century, where Queen Maeve, about to set out with her army to invade Ulster, sees a young woman approaching, driving a chariot. Wonderful description of a young woman. She has a speckled cloak with a gold pin, a red embroidered hood, Her hair is in three plaits, one of which hangs right down to her ankles, and her eyes have triple irises, I guess concentric, you know, three concentric circles, so when she looks at you it must be an unforgettable gaze. "What is your name?" Maeve said to the girl. "I am Fedelm, and I am a woman poet of Connaught." "Have you the imbas for us nigh, the light of foresight?" Maeve said. "Yes, I have," the girl said. "Then look for me and see what will become of my army." So the girl looked. Maeve said, "Fedelm, prophetess, how seest thou the host?" And Fedelm said in reply, "I see it crimson, I see it red." You see that since Fedelm is a poet, it's assumed that she can see the future, albeit not a future that Maeve welcomes, because it means the slaughter of her army. We're familiar, of course, with the myth of the classical Mediterranean world, where the muses were the goddesses who dwelt on Mount Helicon, guarding the sacred spring of divine water that gave inspiration to those who drank from it. Again, we have the idea of poetic inspiration as a drink, and a drink which is in the keeping of supernatural women. I've recalled to these myths because I want us to remind ourselves of the depth, the importance of what poets do and the fundamental part that poetry plays, whether visibly or invisibly, in a culture. Looking at these myths, it's clear that what they transmit is the memory of a shamanic role of ordeals and initiations into the depths of consciousness. We, as poets and as readers of poetry, must be prepared to dive deep into that ocean of contemplation, the silence, if you like, between words and things, which is, I think, precisely that aporia, or gap, which the deconstructionists argue cannot be crossed or bridged. It's the poet who bridges that abyss for an instant with his or her own body and mind.
Following on from Greville's comments about what poets are, here's Swithin Cooper introducing his poem from the Younger International Poets event, where he says basically that poets can be as pretentious as they like. So it's over to Swithin.
One of the things I love about poems is you can be as pretentious as you like, and it's part of the deal, really. No one bats an eyelid. This is about when, after you've broken up with someone, and their movements still sort of inform a lot of your decisions, and you're desperately trying not to know what they're doing. But you can't really help yourself finding out what they're up to. And the area where I live, there's a sort of, every time I walk home late at night, I see the foxes going through the bins, and I feel like they're the externalised souls of me and my neighbours. City foxes have arrived again and are screaming in the streets. Ribbed and underfed, they tear at bin bags, release the yellowing stench of rotten food. Coming home after midnight, I watch as they freeze between the cars in the mood to fuck or fight. We stare each other out and turn away. They know me. They know why I walk this route. Past your lit windows, your growing recycling, the crystal flakes on the neck of that bottle of wine. You're no better than them, and they're no worse than me. When they howl like a sine wave cut with a baby's cry, it's only as loud as the neon pink graffiti that tags the walls and names the territory. The benefit sheets, their scavenged scraps of cash, the mums who grab and twist the hair of kids who skip school to eat crisps on filthy floors, and you and me, our dinners, drinks and fights. My God, when we get going, the noise we make. Thank you.
The next of our younger international poets is Gaelic poet Katrina Lexi Campbell, who was the winner of the Gaelic Prize at the Wigtown Book Festival in 2008. So it's over to Katrina.
I was working on a project about wolves and the reintroduction of wolves into the Highlands. And it came to my attention that the extermination of the wolves, or the removal of the wolves from the Highlands, happened around 1745, at the same time as the Jacobite Rebellion, after which Gaelic sort of went into quite a major decline. So I kind of started to draw these parallels between the two things. So this is just a small poem that I wrote on that subject. And it's called Matagali, which means wolf. Rúisc de Valau, ha farsinioc na biantan I fuscalig mar miaran, bialcan ioclan, chige ganachig. Dachian ish fuari gan chaintin to hulan, the blachach ga cushid, the cordach of nacraven. Gnervid is ganim, han talu a chidamurig, bachai dan yarsh dogne. Tafikimi mafik youth, getai some nach go gdim, binyu mission sholat, a steel of tarshing starring na hanchi galich, yar tu ich heim. Translation. It's called Wolf. Naked since your departure, the expanse of the mountains opens like a yawn, a mouth without teeth, a tongue without words, a home now bleak without the fires of your eyes, warming each vein, covering the bones. Without reason and without use, the land dries, since it lost the might of your presence. I will offer you my neck, though I know that you will not bite. I belong here with you, tearing across the moonlit night paths of our own land.
And from the moonlit night paths of Scotland to the snake-filled world of Eden in perhaps Austria, from Austrian poet and singer Andreas Unterweger. So, over to Andreas.
Die Schlange, the snake. Ich bin der Schlange nie begegnet. Die Frau war's. Die Frau hat sie gesehen, nicht ich. Ich weiß ja, dass es keine Schlangen gibt. Es gibt keine Schlangen. Jedenfalls nicht bei uns im Garten. Das habe ich der Frau weiß Gott wie oft gesagt. In unserer Gegend gibt es ebenso wenig Schlangen, habe ich ihr gesagt, wie es Engel gibt. Aber die Frau tickt anders. Die Frau sieht Schlangen. Die Frau sitzt tagelang in ihrer dunklen Kammer und sieht Schlangen. Und ich, der ich doch täglich draußen unten am Fluss die Bäume schneide, ich sehe nichts. Nichts außer etwas gelbem Laub und schwarzen Zweigen. Schwarzen, schlanken, glatten Zweigen, die aussehen wie frisch geschnitten und flussaufwärts treiben. The snake. I never met the snake, but the wife did. The wife saw it, not me. I know that there are no snakes. There are no snakes, at least not here, not in our garden. This is what I told the wife, God knows how many times. There are no snakes around here, I told her, just as there are no angels. But the wife is different. The wife sees snakes. The wife is sitting for days in her dark room and sees snakes. And I, who stays outside every day, down by the river, cutting the trees, I do not see anything. Nothing except some yellow leaves and black twigs. Black, slim, smooth twigs, looking like they have been recently cut and drifting upstream.
For more information on the poets and the Younger International Poets event, go to our website, stanzapoetry.org. Next up, it's our second visit from Grendel Lindop, this time in his guise as a poet.
A few years ago, I was lucky enough to be invited to produce a new edition of The White Goddess by Robert Graves, and to work on his papers I went to his former house in Mallorca. Before I left, his widow insisted on taking me down into the orchard that they'd planted together and helping me to pick some lemons, which I brought back to the UK, I think in defiance of customs regulations, but we won't worry about that. So this is what happened to the lemons, and it's called Five Lemons. Here are five lemons from the poet's garden, the colour of white gold and icy sunshine, flooded with green around the pointed nipples. My younger daughter cuts one into quarters, careful of fingers, bites the white furred pith out, devours the quartz white segments with her eyes shut, sighing and swaying in the sharp enjoyment. Here are four lemons from the poet's garden, one perched on three, a perfect tetrahedron. The poet's widow showed me where to pick them, kindly and shrewd, helping me find the best ones, holding the branch down while I snapped the stalks off, the cold breeze in our faces from the mountain. We'll halve this one and squeeze it over couscous. Here are three lemons from the poet's garden, still in the bowl, turned in a neat triangle, yellower now. My elder daughter chooses, after long thought, one for her still life painting, the twisted leaves like green airplane propellers, where the Cézanne pear and a Braque violin fractured into Art Deco cubist slices. Here are two lemons from the poet's garden, below his tall house on the terraced hillside, red earth black pitted with his fallen olives, between the gnarled trunks trailing silver foliage, beside the boulders of the dusty torrent, rainless above that sea of sparkling turquoise. The juice is perfect for a tuna salad. Here is a lemon from the poet's garden, the last of them. Long is the poet gone, silent his grave on the hilltop under the cypress. Long the shadows drawn by moon and sun out from the low walls and high gate of the graveyard. I press the waxy peel to my face and breathe it. There are no words for what the fragrance tells me. One of the less known episodes of the Second World War was that in 1940 the Air Ministry decided to cover up all of the ancient chalk hill figures, the Long Man of Wilmington, the White Horse of Berkshire, and so on, because they could serve as landmarks, navigation aids for the bombers. My father was a cadet at OCTU, the Officer Cadet Training Unit at that time, and he found himself sent off to help to cover up the White Horse on the Berkshire Downs. He told me about this, and I just felt there was such a depth, a legendary, mythical depth to this episode, that I had to write something about it. And to my surprise, the poem came out not only commemorating the event, but becoming a poem about love for my father, and about the difficulty of expressing that love, covering things up, in fact. White Horse. 1940, a summer of mythical heat. And up on the Berkshire Downs, my father in khaki, with an OCTU contingent spread out over the hillside, spading slabs of turf off the back of a lorry to bury the white horse. Square by square, the turf is laid and the blinding chalk goes under the rough green skin of the down, secure from the moon's betrayal and the jealous bomber. When landmarks were allowed again, someone else dug it up. Perhaps he would have liked to share in that restorative work, but had no chance to turn his hand to it. And how much more of England, of us, stayed buried after those years, those wars? Whatever is concealed may be forgotten. The moment of doubt, the toy soldier, the gold collar sunk in the stubborn field. Protecting ourselves, it's ourselves we bury. And with time, the ploughshares of habit go over until the desire or the thing unspoken seem ordinary dullness lodged in stony ground. Father, let us uncover the white horse of love, delicate as a bone brooch, solid as the chalk heart of the down, the ground on which we move, undiminished, cut, free, and living into the rock.
Greville was featuring in Brian Johnson's director's cut strand of this year's stanza, and he was accompanied by award-winning poet Jean Sprackland, whose latest collection, Tilt, won the Costa Award for Poetry.
It's just so lovely to be here, and it takes a very long time to get here from almost anywhere, I suspect. But it was really great to be on a train for so long yesterday. Sometimes, if you have space on the train, it's just a joy. I'm going to read two poems which have to do with train journeys. Poets always write about train journeys because we spend so much time on trains, I think. But these two poems, they're very different. The first one is, I had a very smooth journey yesterday, but it's about a different kind of train journey where everything goes wrong and essentially the train just sort of stops in the middle of nowhere. That's happened to all of us, I'm sure. And in the poem, the train has a character of its own, a motivation of its own. The stopped train. She stands and knows herself for the first time. This recognition comes to each of us sooner or later. When a baby meets a mirror, it enters this same state of rapture. That's how the train is, stunned and passionate. She looks and sees energy, will, destiny, sees that she touches the rails, but is not the rails, brushes the overhead lines and drinks in power, is headstrong and pioneering. Inside, passengers cram the corridors, sucking ice cubes, taking turns at the windows. A woman shouts, "Why must you all be so British?" The carriage is brash with daylight, like a terrible living room filling up with unsaid things. No one can get a signal here in this nondescript England of sly ditches and flat fields where some experiment must be taking place, and the only thing moving between the trees is shadow. This is the interior. And if they were to smash the glass with a shoe, jump down onto the track, set off in a somewhere direction, they would be struck down like stranded motorists in Death Valley. The train has forgotten them. She is accounting for herself. Steel, glass, plastic, nylon, an audit of chips and circuits. She stands and ticks, letting the heat leak and equalise. And the poem that I'm going to read with that one is about something that you used to see a lot from the windows of trains. In that sort of odd mood you can have on a long train journey of being suspended between parts of your real life and with nothing to do, nothing you have to do, nothing you can do, but just look. And I think you see things rather differently in that frame of mind. I used to see a lot of mattresses beside railway lines, and somehow you don't anymore. I don't know why. They've all been cleared away. Mattresses. Tipped down the embankment, they sprawl like sloshed suburban wives, buckled and split, slashed by rain, moulded by bodies dead or disappeared, and reeking with secrets. A lineside museum of sleep and sex, an archive of thrills and emissions, the histories of half-lives spent hiding in the dark. Arthritic iron frames might still be worth a bit, but never that pink quilted headboard, naked among thistles, relic of some reckless beginning, testament to the usual miracle, the need to be close, whatever the stains or the bruises.
Next up we have Stanza podcaster Supremo Al Innes interviewing this year's artist in residence, Jay Bernard. This being Jay's second stanza, Al started off by asking, was there a difference in the way she was approaching the festival through the eyes of an artist rather than just as a participant?
I've been approaching it in a completely different way. I've been drawing as opposed to like sitting and listening, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Obviously you still listen, but it's a completely different way of doing it, and I've never done it this way before, so I'll have
that's,
to see.
That's interesting, so it's different than sort of drawing, different from writing. Do you think you listen differently? Or?
Yeah, because you... Because basically, what I find myself doing is looking up and down the whole time. And even though I can kind of hear, I'm following the reading, my aim is to draw them, do you know what I mean? And I only have, like, the sort of 10 minutes in some cases that they're standing there reading. Sometimes it's half an hour, which is a lot better, but when it's half an hour, you want a slightly more detailed drawing, so it's still the same, you know, it's all relative. I mean, so, yeah, you're kind of, like, hearing snaps as opposed to, like, following the whole thing. And so what I find is that I write down just like particular images, and that's what sticks. So it will all come down to, I think, like in terms of highlights, it will all come down to how the work turns out in the end, as yeah. opposed to like what I was hearing at the time.
So we're in the Bayer Theatre here. Is this quite a visual place?
I think it's a really good hub for like the festival to like focus on stuff, because you get to see loads of people, like the festival organisers and the sort of people just coming to the festival and the performers and everything. We're all kind of like mixed together. And it's nice. It's not exclusive. It's not aggressive. It's not like hostile. I came last year, and last year I think I had about 48 hours in St. Andrews, and I managed to see pretty much everything in that time. So I was like determined that I wasn't just going to like, you know, amble around and everything, having come this far up north. So I saw most of the historic sites, but the other day, well, yesterday, and went over. I can't remember what the name of the actual ruin is, but where St. Rule's Tower is, basically.
Is it the cathedral?
Is it just the cathedral?
It's St. Andrew's Cathedral, yeah.
Okay, well, there we go.
So you're enjoying having more time than this is the
cathedral? Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's a really lovely way to experience a festival this way, because you get to go to everything that you want to go to, everything that happens to arrive. So it's almost like you've got, like, personal choice, even though you're, like, obliged to do it. It's kind of like a nice combination. You're not obliged to read yourself, even though everyone knows that you're also a writer, which is lovely, because it means that, you know, you can use your kind of poetic interest to inform your art, and people have to wait for it. You know what I mean? No one's asking you to, like, do stuff, be on stage at a particular time. And so the whole thing is a kind of act. And it's, I don't know, I think it's really, like, liberating and nice. But then again, that could just come out of the fact that I've been doing it for so long that I'm getting kind of sick of constantly being on stage, you know what I mean? It's nice to be, like, just depicting other people and, like, supporting other people in a way, because the point about this project, from my perspective, in terms of what I intend to do, is that it's not just about the famous people, because I don't think Stanton is just about famous people. You get, like, massive names, totally, and, you know, it's very prestigious and everything, but it seems to me that the energy of the festival is also about getting people onto the stage, like new people, or, like, you know, showing new people, and that to me is more interesting than, you know, just going to see the big names. So, like, in terms of what I'm going to do, the most interesting bit is, like, seeing how I will, like, present those, like, smaller people, you know, like, to say to people next year, like, look at all these, like, great people who you probably didn't even know were at this festival.
Okay, Jay Bernard, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Next up, we've got the opportunity to hear from Jamaican poet and novelist Kai Miller, who reads from his new collection, A Light Song of Light, which will be published by Carcanet in July.
At the Stanza launch, I began with a poem called Some Definitions for Light. Today I'm going to start with a poem called, one of its sister poems called Some Definitions for Song. Some Definitions for Song. The speech of birds, as in birdsong, but with exceptions. Pigeons do not sing. Vultures do not sing. A bargain, or a very small sum, as in he bought it for a song. Think what we could purchase with songs, thrown across the counter and landing more softly than coins. Perhaps then the origin of the expression to sing for your supper. The troubled sound that escapes from a woman's mouth while she dreams of fire. Also any sound that escapes, also anything that escapes. A passage out, the fling up of hands, a prison break is a song. The parting of the Red Sea was a song. In Israel, there are many songs, but there should have been 6 million more. Across the Atlantic, there are many songs, but there should have been 10 million more. Song was a state during the Eastern Zhou spring and autumn period, 770 to 476 BC. Its capital was Shangku. Anything that climbs is a song. Vines are a song. My father, 70 years old at the top of the Aki tree, is a song. All planes are songs. Song was a low-cost airline operated by Delta. Tourists were flown by Song to Florida. Song's last flight was on the 30th of April, 2006. All that pleases the heart, all that pleases the ear, the final measure of joy, when we have lost Song, we have lost everything. A common surname in Korea, often transliterated as Sum. What would it mean if your name was Song? Song was the third and final album of Lullaby for the Working Class. It was released on the 19th of October, 1999. Songs often refer to songs, as in, he shall encompass me with a song. Sing unto the Lord a new song. Sing a song of sixpence. Sing a song. Sing a song. all of the collection, I keep on referring to this guy who in Jamaica we call, I mean, this is kind of before my time, we call him the Singer Man. And it's just one of those facts that fascinated me, that when they had gangs building roads, they would hire someone as a part of the road gang whose job was to sing songs. And this was the Singer Man. And the Singer Man comes in and out of the collection. And so I'll read a couple of the Singer Man poems. A short biography of the Singer Man. The Singer Man, born in 1903, has lived in Spalding in Lime Tree Grove in a village called Rim. Wherever there were no roads, wherever the hills rose up like a flock of green parrots, you would find him. Singer Man paid half shilling a week, dug trenches, filled the pits with mortar and bits of broken stone. But Singer Man's most crucial job was to lift up mentors, time Chichibodo to the swing of a workman's hammer, and no one knew if it was the hammer or if it was the song, but no rock was so strong to resist the fourth accented beat, that huh, in the Singer Man's song. Brochure. And this is if you're ever going to Jamaica. Brochure. Avoid the three-lane highways. Drive on the Singer Man's roads. Your journey, even when bumpy, will be sweet. The ascents lifting you as in a chorus. The sharp corners turning you like a force of melody. There is a back road that sings its offbeat way up Stony Hill, built, of course, by the Singer Man. And the slim road to Mount Pleasant, also built by the Singer Man. And yes, it was the Singer Man who orchestrated the long road to Portland, made it full of waterfalls so that a man and his mule traversing the miles can forget for a while the solemnity of their loads. Please, when you visit Jamaica, drive on the Singer Man's roads. The colour of the Singer Man's songs. If the Singer Man had gone to America, he would have sung the blues. He would have sung the blues with a voice like John the Baptist, with a voice with a tongue covered in sand, and his blues would have been that kind of blues that is fed on locust and honey, blues like a cry that cometh from the wilderness, blues like the sound of warthogs alarmed at the sky. And the Singer Man would have sung it straight from his field in Arkansas to Harold Arlen's sitting room, and Arlen would have gone to the Keys to write a song more sad than blues in the night. But the Singer Man did not go to America. He stayed right here. So bless up to him and his song and all music that is sad in its own color. Bless up to the notes that fall like flakes of rust. Bless up to every song that makes its own way out of dungle, a path straight through ghettos. Bless up to the mentor which becomes ska, which becomes rubber dub, which becomes legend. Bless up all the red gold songs, the weary evening time songs, songs given to us by the Singer Man.
Well, that's it for another very full day of the Stanza Festival. We hope that you've enjoyed the selections that we've made for today's podcast. And we hope you'll listen in to tomorrow's podcast, where we'll feature the same mix of different things happening at the Stanza Festival. Thanks for listening.